Welcome to season two of Scared to Death podcast. This podcast is organized and presented by undergraduate and graduate students in the Terror Management Lab at James Madison University. I am Dr. Lindsay Harville Bowman, the director of this laboratory, and today I am thrilled to be joined by Dr. John Hathcote, who is an associate professor in the Department of Graduate Psychology and associate assessment specialist in the Center for Assessment and Research Studies here at James Madison University.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yay. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, I think you did a nice introduction for me. I'm an associate professor of graduate psychology. I specialize in educational assessment, research, evaluation, measurement, and statistics. I teach courses in measurement theory, statistics, performance assessment, and those types of things here at JMU. I've been here for about 9 years or so.
Awesome. Thank you. So I know you're originally from Oklahoma. We do have that connection. But can you share with us a little bit about your path to your current position at JMU from Oklahoma?
Yes, I can. I guess I would say that most of this I would consider to be somewhat happenstance in various ways. I guess I would start by saying that, where should I start? Maybe as a child?
Oh, well, right? We could go all the way back there if you'd like.
You want to go back there? Yeah, I don't know where to start with that because, I would say that my kind of family life at that time, and let's go back. Why not?
We're going back.
Let's do a mini therapy session. Okay, for me,
great.
Because I could use some therapy sometimes. I would say that, you know, growing up, my childhood was not by any means a happy childhood. There were various, you know, don't get me wrong, I was not, like, abused or anything like that. Many people have very difficult childhoods. But I would say that there is various forms of what you might call, like, mental violence in various ways. As a teenager, I never really imagined myself even going to university. That was not something that even crossed my mind at the time. I experimented with various types of substances to say the least, got hooked for a while on meth, amphetamines, got into some trouble eventually and ended up going to this fundamentalist kind of boot camp, if you will, for 9 months. I was supposed to be there for 13 months, and I left prior to when I was supposed to leave. Mainly because, basically during that camp, we would work for half the day, labor for half the day. And eventually I started to pose these questions and have doubts and various things. And the people there eventually said, well, you've got maybe this kind of spirit of doubt, right? And I remember them praying over me, right? And it was actually during these prayers that I decided that I had to get out of the situation. I had to leave. And I thought to myself that I was going to go back to this. I would still be in trouble, right? But ended up, all of that was dropped, right? Come back and I'm thinking, what am I going to do with my life at this point? So my stepfather at the time said, well, why don't you try university, try college out? So I was immediately attracted to the fields of psychology and philosophy, primarily because I thought that these areas might, you know, answer some particular questions that I have about who we are, what we are, our place in the universe, so to speak. And I admired the theorists that I was reading about, and I wanted to, in some sense, contribute to knowledge in some way, right? And what else? Yeah, after that, I got a master's. I knew that I wanted to do research, and I ended up getting a master's in educational research and evaluation with a specialization in research, evaluation, measurement, and statistics, and so forth. And at the time, I really considered that to be an area of weakness for me, but I wanted to specialize in something that I thought was a weakness to make that more into a strength of some kind. It was during graduate school, I ended up getting a PhD in the same area, and it was during graduate school that I ended up with my ex, who I was with for 8 or 9 years. I've never been married or anything like that, but that's a whole other kind of story. We ended up having a child together. I have a daughter, and I had to find a job of some kind. And I originally was interested during graduate school of studying more the psychology of religion and applying what I was learning to some of the measurement issues within that area. And I ended up taking a job as an analyst for an assessment office there at the university. And I ended up getting interested. I was looking around at the assessment community, and I realized that these people need help. And I thought, well, maybe I could apply my skills to this kind of situation or to this area in some sense. So that's ultimately what I ended up doing. The skill set is in high demand for educational assessment. There are not many jobs out there for people who want to study the psychometric properties of instruments designed in the psychology of religion. So that's kind of what I did. And then JMU had a position that was open. I applied to various places, but this seemed like a natural fit for me. Thanks. Yeah, so that's kind of it was all happenstance. None of this was planned.
Of course. Well, yeah. Sometimes it works out that way. Yeah, thanks for sharing your story. I think so many people think that that path from, you know, everyone that has a PhD, we started out as the smart kids in undergrad and moved. Not that you're not smart, you're very intelligent, but I was not the smart kid in undergrad, right? And so you think that PhDs have a certain path, and it's not always like that. We all have varying backgrounds.
No, most definitely not. Yeah, like I said, if anything, university life was not something I even remotely considered at the time. I was, at the time, living a complete life of crime, if you will. Like, I was doing all kinds of things, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A different kind of life.
Yeah, a very different kind of life.
Than you lead now. How have these experiences kind of led you toward finding your truth, whether that be capital T or lowercase t, truth?
I'm not sure that I've found truth, to be honest. I've always been searching throughout the course of my life for meaning, and I don't think that that's come to an end, and I don't know that that will ever come to an end. That period in my life was a period of darkness, but that also reminds me of a famous story, right? I'm sure that many of you have heard the story of the person who have lost their keys, right? And they're looking for their keys and out on the street somewhere. And when they find, they're mainly looking underneath the lamp, the light pole, right? The light pole is where they're looking. And when you ask them, well, why are they looking there? And it's like, well, that's where the light is brightest, right? But that's not necessarily where we would find our keys, right? And I think you have to look into the darkness as well. You do have to look into the darkness sometimes to find those keys. And I spent a long time looking into that darkness. And I would say it's not something I would necessarily recommend, because I know many people who have done that and have never returned, right? So there are dangers doing that, those things.
Yeah, absolutely. You can come out on the other side, like you are incredibly, you know, having gained some meaning out of it, right? But a lot of people are not able to come out of that darkness. So
yes, many people. Yeah. I consider myself to be quite lucky.
I would agree.
In that regard. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you have a recent book chapter that talks a little bit about truth and knowledge and epistemology and ontology. And so before we get into epistemology and ontology, I know you say that you haven't necessarily found truth. If you were to give it a definition, what is truth to you? What's truth?
That's a really complicated question. And I will just say that I currently don't know. The reason that it's a complicated question is that there are various books that have been written on this topic. It's a topic that's still currently debated. There are numerous theories of truth, right? There's a correspondence theory of truth, a coherence theory of truth, a pragmatist theory of truth, constructivist theories of truth, and so forth. And I do not necessarily adhere to any of these theories of truth per se. However, I do suspect that perhaps for this concept to make some kind of sense, I tend to suspect that some version of the correspondence things, like we're getting maybe something right? That I find it quite difficult to explain. Well, I tend to think more about science, right? And those types of things. And when we look at what we've been able to achieve through science, it seems to me that we're getting something right. I don't know exactly what that something it seems to me like we are getting something right. At least that's what I hope, that we're getting something right. It gets quite complicated.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. It's a big question.
It is a big question. And like I said, there are various versions of this. You can take, though, I think, the success of science. Well, I don't know. Let's think about what we do, right? Mm-hmm. Say in the social sciences. Does depression exist? Is it real? How do you know that it's real?
Right.
What about, you know, self-esteem? Mm-hmm. Grit, right? Are these entities of some kind that we are trying to detect with our measurement procedures? Or are they more maybe something like a useful fiction in some way? Useful in the sense that they are useful ways to summarize patterns and data, and that, you know, that way of doing it might be more useful than other ways of describing things, and that it can handle, in some sense, a greater breadth of empirical reality, so to speak. And it allows us to achieve, maybe they're useful fictions in the sense that it allows us to achieve the things that we want to achieve, given our interests and values and so forth. I suspect, honestly, that various things that we study in the social sciences are best conceived as useful fictions, though I like to think of them as maybe some, I hope that some of those things are real.
Right.
Right. And that leads to other questions, right? If there are, if we can make this distinction between certain phenomena or whatever that, let's say, are real and those that are not real, well, how do we determine which ones are the real ones and which ones are the useful fictions? And does it really matter? I don't know. I don't have answers to those questions, really, but I think they're interesting to think about those questions.
Yeah, I agree. So as we think about knowledge and this vast departure into knowledge and what it is and how we produce it, can you give us a brief definition of epistemology and ontology in regards to your view on knowledge?
Yeah, well, first I just want to say I'm not an epistemologist.
Of course.
And I'm not a philosopher, right? I've studied these things, and at best what I try to do is to take some of these concepts and see how they apply to what we do, right? So I kind of at times work at this boundary or intersection between these different disciplines in some sense. So what is epistemology? Epistemology is the study of knowledge, right? What does it mean to know something? How do we know what we know, right? So what is knowledge? How do we justify our claims to knowledge and so forth? What's the relationship between the knower and the known? According to the most traditional view, which is a view that I tend to like, knowledge would consist of a true, justified belief, right? So knowledge is just not something that, so for example, I may believe things. I could believe all kinds of things. Some of those things might be true. Some of those things might not be true. So at a very minimal requirement, we at least need a belief to be true for it to count to say I know something. However, that in itself is not adequate. We still need some kind of justification for what I believe, because you can accidentally believe things that are true and so forth. So how do we know what we know? Much of epistemology focuses on a justification of knowledge. With respect to ontology, ontology is more about the kinds of things that exist, right? What constitutes the world or this stuff out here? So when we get into questions about the ontology of depression or something, you know, something like, what is it, right? Is it a thing? Is it a social construction, right? So when we look at diagnostic criteria, we could look at those different views have huge implications for how we would think about what we're doing. So for example, if I think that I'm attempting to detect an entity of some kind, then my instrument's trying to detect this and so forth, and we can get it right, we can get it wrong, right? So there would be implications for what we think about diagnosis and so forth. But other people may look at these things and view it completely as a social construction, right? That it's really just the manifestation of these socially constructed diagnostic criteria and so forth. And those ontological views, as well as what I think about how I know about the world, have huge implications for my research procedures and so forth. And that's kind of, I guess, what the paper... I've thought quite a bit about those types of topics. Even though I'm not an epistemologist, study metaphysics.
Of course, but you're a measurement guy, right? So figuring out how to measure these things can be problematic, right? I mean,
oh, it's hugely problematic.
Is there anything specific that keeps you up at night that you could tell us about in regards to epistemology and ontology?
In
measurement,
I've stopped losing sleep over epistemology and ontology.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, I lose sleep over all kinds of things. But I've tried to.
Not let that
ruin my sleep anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because epistemology and ontology is so subjective for scholars and non-scholars, anybody really, you can get, especially in the academic world, pretty heated debates, right, among those. And so what do you think, why do you think that's such a sticking point for academics and philosophers and anybody really? Why are those two things causing us to get into such big arguments with each other?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And really, these frameworks, if you will, and there are different kinds of frameworks that we really haven't talked about, but there may be different, there are lens, right? There are a way that we can view the world and think about the world and think about what I'm doing and the kinds of conclusions that I draw and so forth. It has huge implications on what it means to know, what am I engaged in, right? And we have disagreements at that level. It can be quite, it creates all kinds of challenges. Why can't we get past these things, or how is it even possible to get past these things? And I don't know for sure. But it reminds me of, like, if we just look at the world around us right now, right, with the current political climate that we're in, the current issues that we have, the history that we've had even throughout this last century, and what do we see but travesty after travesty, right, slaughtering people for various reasons, right? We can't seem to even talk to each other anymore, right? And it's very much the same kind of thing. It's not, you know, people are not slaughtering each other over some of these things, but
not yet.
I think it's the same type of thing, right? Like, as humans, why are we engaged in this? Why do we treat the so-called other the way that we do? I don't know, but I know we're subject to all kinds of biases and so forth as humans, and the people who study this stuff are human. We're subject to these things, whether we like it or not. And whether we're even being aware of it is maybe the best that we can do. But we're at least aware of these tendencies and try to guard against those tendencies, but people are still people. And for whatever reason, humans seem to be these kinds of creatures that have a propensity to do quite wonderful things and as well quite horrible things to each other.
Yeah. Terror management theory obviously has, you know, an opinion on that, that it would be tied to your fear of death and the and that as an explanation of why we can't get along with others. So along those lines of death, we're getting older.
We are.
Yeah, both. We're pretty much, you and I are very similar in age. We're close. So as you inch closer to death, right, how have your views on life changed as you've gotten older?
Yeah. So have you ever read the book? It's a children's book called The Little Prince. If not, I suggest you read it.
I will.
Because it is quite insightful for a children's book. There's much wisdom in that book. And that has affected me in the last few years recently, I would say. It's a story about a little prince who lives in this other world and is traveling to other worlds and kind of teaching these life lessons and so forth. And one of the lessons that comes from that book really pertains to issues of the heart, right? Issues of love and those types of things. And I think that when I was younger, especially during that period of darkness, I abandoned those ideas. I abandoned those concepts in the favor of the pursuit of knowledge, right? And the pursuit of development and so forth. In many ways, because I think it was safe. And what that has taught me, what that book has taught me, was that it is through the heart, our heart, that we're able to see things clearly. And the heart can see things better than the eyes at times. And that's something that I've learned as I've aged. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that has been a hard lesson to learn as I've aged, that the heart, I've learned to be more open, and I've learned to allow myself to be vulnerable, whereas before I would see vulnerability as a weakness. And instead now, I think allowing myself to be vulnerable is a strength in many ways. Yeah, so those are the lessons that I've learned. Or some of the lessons
that's
that
beautiful.
I've learned. Well, thank you.
I like that.
It's a beautiful book.
I will definitely check it out. Are you afraid of death, John?
I don't think death is something to fear.
Okay.
Death itself, at least under my view, isn't bad. It's the timing of death that's bad. If you think about death and our own death, which I've been thinking quite a bit about, I suppose, recently. Like I said, I think it's the timing that's bad. Death comes, the reason that the timing is bad is because death comes before I'm able to experience the things that I want to experience, before I'm able to do the things that I want to do, and so forth. That's what makes death bad. Death itself is a gift in many ways. And if we were able to live, let's say, infinitely, you would ultimately end up getting bored. I've done everything I want to do. I've seen everything I want to do. It would become a hell to live forever, unless you had some kinds of novelty, or you'd have to have something new or something. So it's not really death itself that scares me. Maybe more the process of dying that's scary, and the timing of death that ultimately makes it bad. And I think that we could think about, like, if you think about what were things like before you were born, is there a likeness to it? There's no likeness to it. There's nothing, right? And I think that's death. It's nothing. It'll be just like before you were born.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So why fear that?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the co-founders of chair management theory, Sheldon Solomon holds very similar views, right?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. The you will, you know, how's the world going to be after you're gone? Well, it'll be just like it was before you showed up, right? Oh, that's hard for people to come to terms with, right?
It's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable.
I think it, but it is the timing of things that make it, that makes it not great. And I think the process of dying is an issue, right? Yeah. Especially, I don't think we take care of our people like we should.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So along those lines, would you want to know the time and place? If you could, would you want to know the time and place of death for you in advance?
So as I've kind of thought about that question or thing, what would be the advantages to knowing?
Stopping it.
Let's pretend you can't stop it.
Yeah.
It's certain that your heart will stop at such and such date, maybe. And there's nothing you can do to prevent it. Would you want to know that? And are there any advantages to knowing that? I suppose that if I knew that my heart would stop at such and such date, that I could put my life in order prior to that date, in theory, right? I could tell the people that I love that whatever I want to say to them, I could get my funeral arrangements arranged or whatever, right? There's no surprise there. I suppose that would constitute an advantage of some kind. So then we could ask the question, well, what are the advantages to our current system of death, right? Are there any advantages to what we have now? And I suppose that there are probably some advantages to this sense of comfort that comes from being naive, right? And there's also this kind of sense of mystery that we don't know and so forth. And even though there might be more advantages to knowing, I'm leaning towards the mystery.
It does make life more exciting. Someday you just show up dead.
yeah. That's funny.
So what brings meaning to your life now? What brings meaning? Yeah. What are those things that, you know, in your life today that you would say, you know, that gives me great meaning? You're living for these things.
Well, let me first say that, and this goes back to maybe your original question about truth, whether it's a capital T truth or a small t truth. I'm not sure that there's a universal meaning or purpose. I don't know that there's purpose to this stuff, right? But I do know that I have purpose, but the purpose is something I create, right? It's something that I build, and it's through what I do and the choices that I make and how I act. Even though I know that all of that is temporary, it's not sustainable, it still gives me meaning. Even if it's temporary, I'm okay with that. So how do I find meaning? It's through everything that I do. Right? Whether it's talking to the people that I talk to, helping people, developing myself further, or whatever the case might be. But it's through the stuff that I do, teaching relationships with people, building relationships with people. And that's also something that I've learned, is that people, the heart, and people matter. And it's all temporary, but at least you can do something for the people here now. And that's meaningful to the people here now, irrespective of whether there's some kind of universal meaning. I've given up on that idea in many ways.
One thing that you didn't mention that I feel might give you great meaning in your life is pickleball.
Okay.
I mean, that's a huge part of your life.
It is a huge part of my life.
I don't know if the people listening to this podcast know this, but they know that now. I'm surprised that you did not mention pickleball.
Well, it's an activity that has definitely increased my sense of mental health and my well-being in various ways. Those activities and the things that I do are part of my meaning, I suppose, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, pickleball.
I wasn't going to let you go without a pickleball reference. So
well, you can reference pickleball. We can have a conversation about pickleball and death.
Yeah, absolutely. death by pickleball. I mean, that's possible, right?
Death by pickleball. I hope not.
So think about that as you go play pickleball later. Yeah,
fear of pickleball death.
Right. So we like to end with a series of rapid fire questions that may or may not have anything to do with what we just talked about.
Yeah, that.
So I'm going to go through, ask you some quick questions, and you can tell me as little or as much as you want. Biking or running?
Running.
Okay.
I've always been decent at running for some odd reason, and running.
Okay. Would you rather watch NBA, MLB, NHL, or NFL?
I have to choose none of the above. I don't like any of those.
Pickleball, right?
No. Well, I do watch pickleball quite frequently, but I would, if I had to pick a sport like that to watch, say a professional sport like that to watch, I really like what Americans would call soccer.
Okay.
The Premier League and Liverpool. I enjoy watching some Liverpool at times, but I don't really watch soccer that much, honestly. But if I had to pick something, that's what I would pick.
Okay. Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate.
Dream job?
I don't know. I enjoy teaching, but if I had to pick something different from what I do now, maybe it'd be kind of cool maybe to be like in a think tank or something like that doing research, or sometimes I have, fantasies of just giving everything up and going to the beach somewhere or mountain somewhere and just hanging out, not doing any, having no responsibility.
Yes. Right? I have dreams of a tiki bar on a remote island if things don't work out. Teaching or learning?
With this one, I would like to say maybe it's a false dichotomy, right? Because every time I teach, I learn. If anything, it enhances and reinforces the things that I have learned. So, and I think you learn best from teaching.
I like that.
Yeah.
Biggest
pet. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Biggest pet peeve?
I despise, maybe that's a harsh word, but pet peeve. I do not really like loud vehicles.
Interesting.
Yes, it annoys me.
Okay.
On the road.
Favorite shot in pickleball?
This may make me sound like not a very nice person, but anytime someone hits a high shot, I really like slamming it.
It's fun.
So, yeah.
I would imagine that's fun. Having dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would it be?
Oh, I don't. I would need to give that some more thought for rapid fire. I'm not quite sure in terms of. Let's say if we stick with the dead person, maybe like Nietzsche.
Hmm. Yeah, that would be an interesting dinner. Optimist or realist?
I like to try to be optimistic, but deep down I'm a realist.
Favorite season?
Fall. It's beautiful.
It is gorgeous today. Mm. Beach or mountains?
I actually prefer the mountains over the beach. The beaches look beautiful, but I often leave there feeling dirty and like I need a shower.
Lots of sand, lots of wind, lots
of
salt.
Yeah.
If you were on death row, what would your last meal be?
Probably steak of some kind.
What scares you?
So I will tell a very brief story. During COVID, one of my neighbors hurt their knee. And during that process, they were unable to walk. They're an older person. Had no one around, right, at all. No family, nothing, no children, anything. In pain, alone. So I helped them for 2 or 3 months, walking their dogs, taking care of them, making sure they had food, and so forth. What scares me is being in that situation by myself in the future. That scares me.
Yeah, absolutely. If you could go back to your younger life, what would you go back and tell yourself?
Things will be okay. Don't stress too much.
Favorite thing about JMU?
JMU has treated me well. So the people that I've met here have been good people. I would say the people that I've met.
Biggest regret?
I try not to. I've done many things that I might be considered bad, and that I would even consider bad, but I don't think about regrets, and I am happy with the person that I am, and I feel like I would not be the person that I am had I not suffered through the things that I've suffered through.
Awesome.
So I don't think about regrets.
I don't either.
Yeah, so, I think it's dangerous in many ways. Mm-hmm. It's a source of depression.
Yes. Maybe. Absolutely.
Whether it's an entity or useful fiction.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Last, what's your favorite thing about your life right now?
I know that this is going to sound very strange, and I'm just going to leave it sound very strange and let it be a mystery, but the people that know me best will know what I'm talking about. I'm just going to say monkeys. And I'll leave it be a mystery.
Okay. I like that. Well, thank you so much for joining us today,
fun.
John.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. To the listener, thank you for joining us today for the Scared to Death podcast with Dr. John Hathcote. This podcast has been organized and presented by undergraduate and graduate students in the Terror Management Lab at James Madison University, and we will see you next time.